Welcome to episode 4 of the Tree Lady Talks, and I can't describe the level of excitement here today because we've got a world first, a tree wrap.
Oh yeah.
It's incredible. Honestly, I never thought that I'd hear one, but I have heard one, and it's just sensational. It's an extract from a wrap that our guest today, Kent Honnell, put together. We met Kent at a hotel in Hong Kong.
Yes, because we were at the International Arboricultural Summit a couple of years ago.
That's right. And when we met Kent, we were having breakfast and he started rapping. And it was just incredible. Do you remember?
It was spellbounding. Funny. And actually, what a brilliant way of putting across a message about a fungus that the general public can think, hey, that's really good. That really means something to me.
I mean, listeners, admit to me, you've heard of our malaria.
There's nothing scarier.
That's the only three words that can come after that if you're going to do a song about it or rap about it. Our malaria,
there's nothing scarier.
There'll be a chapter marker on this podcast for that, so you can scroll down to see where about that comes. But it's worth listening to, I'm telling you. It's just, I mean, it's not Grandmaster Flash, to be honest, but, you know, it's just in its own way. I just think it's fantastic. It's characters in ARB, and that's what we need.
That's what we need.
You're feeling rotten, maybe you've forgotten to listen to a tree lady talk.
Kent Honnell has worked for Rainbow Company of Minnetonka, Minnesota since 1994, serving as a technical arborist, a consulting arborist, and currently as arborologist, a name we like. More of that later.
He holds a bachelor's degree from St. Olaf's College and studied ecological horticulture at the University of California at Santa Cruz.
Kent has been an ISA board certified master arborist since 2007 and acquired his ISA tree risk assessment qualification in 2016.
Kent also serves as adjunct faculty in arboriculture for Hennepin Technical College in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, USA.
Minneapolis is located on the ancestral land of the Dakota people. The state name of Minnesota is a Dakota word meaning the land of sky-tinted waters. I'm going to go there.
So welcome to Kent Honnell from Minnesota. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while.
Me too, because we met a couple of years ago in Hong Kong for a conference, didn't we? And we kind of kept in touch. So, Kent, for the listeners, tell us a bit about yourself, how you got into arboriculture and what you do now.
In the early 1990s, I was in horticulture school in Santa Cruz, California, and I started to develop really the more particular interest in tree crops, orchards, that sort of thing. And then was actually given a book of poems by Hermann Hesse, the German writer, by one of my German professors from my college days. And that so inspired me that I decided to devote my career to caring for trees. Not many arborists, I think, start from a poetic basis, but you know, it was really my horticulture studies and then Hermann Hesse that steered me towards what I do now. And I'm speaking to you right now from Minneapolis, Minnesota. For those not familiar with American geography, Minnesota is right in the center of the continent, and Minneapolis is sitting on the Mississippi River, which is just maybe half a kilometer from my house. We sit right on the transition line between the Great Plains and the Northern Forest, where you think of the great north woods of pine, spruce, birch. If you go to the north, you find that. If you go to the south and west, it opens up to the Great Plains. But the transition between those two would have oaks, maple, elm, mixed hardwood species. So we've got quite a great diversity of tree cover here to work with. And Minnesota's really most well known for the northern part of the state with the lakes, the canoe travel, the pine forest, that sort of thing.
So quite a high tree population density then, would you say, in an urban area? What's it like in the towns and cities in Minnesota in terms of tree cover?
It's pretty high and diverse with increasing diversity. You know, as we've spoken a little bit before about the ash borer in our exchange of emails, the arrival of emerald ash borer has really prompted our cities to work towards a greater diversity. In the 70s, 60s and 70s, we had Dutch elm disease that really destroyed elm trees, which were a very high percentage of our urban forest. it got to be, well, we just replaced them with ash trees for a large part. You know, Minneapolis had 22% of its urban forest in ash, you know, so that was a quite high reliance on one species. And now that's being taken out. But now as I walk around my home, I can see maybe 5 to 10 new species that are being replaced in some of these spots, taking into account what will be appropriate with climate change as well.
So what species are you replacing ash with?
Oaks, maples, even a deciduous conifer known as tamarack here. I mean, you would probably know it as larch. There's European larch, but we have an American larch. I've seen a few of those just within a few blocks of my house. And smaller stature trees for being under power service lines, things like serviceberry, ironwoods. It's hard to even keep up with what's coming now. And if we look to the states to the south of us, there are more species that we can start bringing into our zone that we can anticipate will make it here. You know, actually, one of the University of Minnesota forest ecologists was saying that by mid to late century, we'll probably lose a lot of our conifer species in Minnesota. But if we manage things properly, we could gain more species from the south. So we'd have a net gain in terms of species, even though we'll lose some of what has defined our character of forest cover historically.
Yeah, we're introducing a lot of exotics actually in our urban areas here in the UK, and there's been some great research on that. But going back to your sort of daily work, you've got two roles, one as a arborologist for Rainbow Tree Care and the other as a lecturer. Tell us about the college that you teach at and what the demographic of the students is.
Oh yes, that's Hennepin Technical College in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. That's one of the suburbs of Minneapolis. And it's a technical school, you know, that's really focused on hands-on learning. So in the COVID era, that's required a bit of adjustment. I could talk more about that later. But a lot of the students are young people that they don't want to go to a university or, you know, the four-year school that gets so much emphasis in the United States educational system. If they're really more hands-on learners looking for a trade background, there'll be young people. But there's also people at other stages of life where they've been in another career and they know some tree people in their circle of friends and they become fascinated with it. I have had people who are mechanics, builders, all sorts of other trades. Maybe they do work for an arboriculture company fixing the chip truck or something, and then they realize, oh, that's really interesting, and they get drawn into the tree area. And some students have even said, if you're in carpentry, the practitioners guard their information against each other. In arboriculture, everyone is kind of like a big family.
Yeah, we're talking about in the last podcast we produced with a wonderful lady, Amelia Williams, about how it is like a family. I mean, you and I met just once in Hong Kong, but we've kept in touch. And I've got friends all over the world, and so have you, and within the UK. And there is that immediate feeling of, well, the old-fashioned world would be fellowship, really, of just sharing a common passion and love. And it's a universal language. It's absolutely wonderful. But I'm really pleased to hear you've got some career changes, because in the UK, I mean, we're really campaigning that people who've sadly lost their jobs because of COVID, particularly in retail and hospitality, might think about going to work in an outdoor job, you know, arboriculture or ecology or landscape. In terms of your students, are there many women? What sort of percentage?
I would say it's probably 50%.
That's brilliant. Oh, you're way ahead of us in the UK.
I got into this industry in the middle 1990s. Back then, it was a very male and very white dominated sort of industry. And now much more diverse to different ethnic groups or people of different racial backgrounds, and especially more women coming in. And I just think it's great because women take a different approach. You know, the women will take more time to make a work plan and do some stretching and collaborate and pace themselves. And over time, they outperform the guys. So it's a really great development, I think. Yeah.
And I'm so pleased you've got a increasing range of ethnic diversity as well. That's something that we're really championing in the UK. Do you find, are people keen to take this course? It sounds like you've always got lots of interest. People wanting to recognize it as being a good career choice.
Yeah, it seems a bit up and down with the student numbers. You know, this semester we're in right now, they didn't have enough students to come into my advanced course. So that's, I have a semester off from it, which is okay. I don't mind that because I have plenty to do at Rainbow Tree Care. But the numbers have some fluctuation. In the fall semester, I might have upwards of 15 or 16 students, which is about all I can handle, really. You know, if we want to have a real quality hands-on experience for all of them, the bigger the group, the more it gets diluted.
One of the things I remember and why I was so keen to get you on the podcast is because you have an amazing imagination on how to put across scientific facts in a really interesting way. You sent me a photograph of Bethany, who illustrated the CODIT model with a whole grain loaf of bread and Edam cheese and celery. So what are you trying to get across there? It sounds like a great lunch to me.
Nobody learns just by listening to a lecture or maybe by reading a book. But the population in general, we'll all have information reach levels of our brain that sinks in more. The more we involve multiple senses, our hands, our scent, our eyes, especially manipulating models of things. So what I decided was very effective, has been great, especially in the time of COVID, because I can give this assignment and they work on it in their homes. But even when we were meeting in person at the campus, I'd give the assignment to the students to build a physical model of the CODIT process, the compartmentalization of decay or disruption in trees. And they could make a slideshow, they could build a physical model with cutout paper or what have you. And many students ended up making cakes, and Bethany made one out of a hollowed out loaf of bread and different charcuterie items, you know. But the whole aim of it is to get them engaged in building something physically with their own hands. And they'll never forget that. And when we're able to meet in person, then we just made it into a nice, fun, well, now we can have some cake or we can eat some sausage and bread, but not in the COVID era. But really, it's all aimed at getting people involved in an experience that's more than just listening to it or looking at someone else talking about it. Like, they involve themselves in it at multiple levels of their mind and body.
And you showed me earlier, and you showed us photographs when we met, of a slice of wood with different sizes of twigs. Now, we're going to put the photograph of that on our new website. So you'll be able to see this, listeners, but perhaps you could explain what it looks like and what it explains.
Well, it's a section out of a log, and it's divided into quadrants. And in two of the quadrants are different cross sections of branches of different diameters. And what this is meant to depict is Ed Gilman's model of how many girdling roots you can remove from a tree and stay within his recommended amount that will still allow the tree some vitality, not be injured too much. Because if we're explaining it, it sounds a bit confusing. He says you can remove 25% of the cross-sectional diameter of roots equivalent to the cross-sectional 25% at DBH height. Until I made that model of it, it just was really confusing to explain. But if you can show someone, well, that means in a 10-inch diameter, well, I'm always trying to convert to metric for the broader world audience. But you know, you divide your quadrant at DBH height into 25% areas, and that's how many root pieces you can cut through.
It's really, really helpful. Have you shown Ed?
He loved it.
Oh, great. That's brilliant. In your work as an arborologist, as that is your job title, it's not a word that we use in the UK, actually.
Well, it's not used anywhere outside of Rainbow Tree Care, actually.
Oh, okay. Tell us about that word.
Well, at first I resisted it, thinking you can't just make up words or, you know, manufacture reality. But then I realized, well...
We do, by the way, all the time, listeners.
Well, sure. But then I realized there was freedom in it, and that Tom Prosser, the founder of Rainbow Tree Care, invented this position for me, and it didn't really exist outside of our company. So, of course, there needs to be a word for it. And so there's myself and two or three others. And our role really is to collect scientific information research relevant to what we're doing and translate it into useful packages for our staff and the public to be able to use. It's a privileged position in that, I'm not out doing the production. I don't mind that, but, I'm getting a bit old really at 56, going on 56 years old to do that. But I get to conduct research, look at the research of others, sift out what is relevant, and then bring it into usable forms for training for our staff and for speaking to public and other colleagues in other parts of the world. So I love it. That's what an arborologist does.
Excellent. And one of the things that you've been looking at is SLAM.
Well, SLAM is an acronym roughly for Slowing Ash Mortality. And the original work was done by Deb McCullough out of Michigan State University. Really, it was starting off as a mathematical model projecting if you are given a metropolitan area anywhere in the world, and it's in the early stages of the arrival of emerald ash borer, what would it look like if you did insecticide treatments on 20% of the ash population and did inventories mapping it in a very kind of a mathematical way? So it started off theoretical. And then Rainbow Tree Care started to apply this model because our metro area, Minneapolis-St. Paul, we first discovered ash borer here in 2009. And I would say because of the application of the SLAM model, bringing it from theory into practice, we've had a far slower progression of ash borer within our metropolitan area relative to any other city in the United States.
Oh, that's good. And are other people taking this on board? Are they learning from what you're doing?
Yeah, it's happening at the individual residential level, but really where the biggest impact comes is municipalities, the little subsections of cities, the suburbs, that they find out about our ability to treat the trees. And with GIS mapping, you know, the first stage is they'll conduct an inventory. They can contract with us to get this inventory taken care of. And then they can make decisions based on condition ratings. Well, we'll remove the worst condition ones, then we'll treat a percentage of the remaining ones. And the result is that you reduce the overall pressure of the arrival of this insect, where you've got budget left to take care of the replanting, the outreach, all the things that a forestry office is supposed to do. And in other parts of the U.S., emerald ash borer just hit them so quickly and so hard that all they could do is try to keep up with removals, and they had no money left for anything else. So, you know, it's really showing how the model was borne out in reality by applying it.
And you speak quite a lot about the disease triangle.
Well, it's a concept from plant pathology or integrated pest management that I've come to really rely on to explain a lot of things, you know, and as everything's changing around the world with climate change, you know, the environment changes and then new pests show up. Well, how it's all tied together in this conceptual framework is the idea that nothing just happens in a vacuum. You know, you have to have host plant or a tree within a given environment that has to be cooperating to make the conditions available for this pathogen or pest to attack the host. And so what our general tendency is, you know, got a problem, take a pill approach, I think, especially in the U.S. Well, what kills that insect? What kills that fungus? Which, you know, it's part of the overall strategy in many cases, but we shouldn't forget the power to increase the vigor of the host or modify the environment in some way. You know, can we modify our irrigation patterns? Can we use mulches? Can we reduce soil compaction? And then the host is vigorous enough where maybe it wards off the pest on its own.
Which is a much better sustainable approach and also has other multiple benefits, you know, increases carbon sequestration, resistance to other pests and diseases. So is there more of a move towards that?
Yeah, there is. And that's what I've been doing my part to push things in that direction, you know, incorporating biochar into the soils.
Oh, yeah. I don't think we have an episode where we don't mention biochar, because it's such an easy thing to use We're interviewing Craig Sams, who is the founder of Carbon Gold, to talk about that for the next podcast. But yeah, I wondered if you were using that a lot in the States as part of your work, and how long you've been using it for.
We've been using that since 2015 in all of our soil remediation programs with the air spade, you know, this forced air tool that breaks up compaction, and then it can be used to mix in biochar and other compost type of products. And then I found out later when Glenn Percival from Bartlett, UK, was over here speaking to us 2 or 3 years ago, and he's pointing towards the systemic acquired response capabilities that biochar has. So not only really bulking up the ability to hold and distribute water, but providing the spaces for microorganisms to live that can actually benefit the whole system of root health and tree health. And yeah, so the work of Glenn Percival, he's another one of the people in the UK that I'm quite fascinated with his work.
I remember, over 10 years ago, he wrote a brilliantly named article. One of my favorite ever titles was, "Do You Take Sugar With Your Tree?" And it was about the use of just ordinary sugar to give a quick carbohydrate fix. And I went around the building sites in London, where I do a lot of my work, literally with a couple of bags of sugar in the car. And if I was doing any route work, I'd say, right, okay. And all these big burly builders would watch me sprinkle sugar on the ground and it'll all be taking the mickey. As we seem to progress forward in arboriculture culture, the more we're looking far more deeply at a holistic view of the tree. And perhaps we can come on to human health in a moment. But rather than a targeted, this is a problem, this is the only solution. Have you had good results? Have you sort of measured the results that you've had?
Well, I haven't measured it with our clients' results or anything. And really the most difficult part about enrolling residential customers in this is that in the US, at least, we're very much in love with our turf. A lot of people don't want to get rid of that turf right up to the edge of their trees. But if they do, then, you know, they're generally quite pleased with what they end up with. I had a client years ago with these chlorotic maples, just pale green. And I outlined for him this proposal to go several meters out in diameter and blast the soil with the air spade and put in manganese sulfate and all these things. And he was really doubtful after we had done it that it hadn't immediately greened up. And he was really upset, even though I explained to him it would take time. Well, then a few years later, I drove past his home and I saw those trees are just like vibrantly dark green. It really worked.
Yeah. That's been my experience. Of course, one of the things of being a consultant, although I might start using the word arborologist now, is that we don't often get to go back and see what we've done. But I've done so many sites in London and in the east of England. I often think, I went there a few years ago. I'll take a bit of a detour. And I have seen some good results. And I've also seen things that haven't quite worked. You know, a disaster of mine was when I air spaded out some Japanese knotweed rhizomes. And I thought, well, I could try and keep this tree. And we knew that the Japanese knotweed needed to be treated. So I got an air spade and sort of took out all these rhizomes and backfilled. It was a sycamore. And that looked very poor for that. So learning from mistakes as well as successes.
Well, I'd say that the ISA talk that I did in December, most of the questions people sent me were regarding biochar. So there's a great interest in it all around the country in the US.
What about the parallels with the human health triangle?
Well, I think it's relevant in almost any regard. You know, if you go to the doctor and say, give me some medicine for this cough, if they don't ask you how many cigarettes you're smoking a day first, there's no amount of codeine that'll keep you away from coughing. You know, if you don't have your other habits, your stress management, your diet, your everything else lined up, you know, your health will suffer. And there's no medicine that's going to fix that for you. And, you know, I think also in terms of disease triangle, it explains how, say, we have mountain pine beetle in the western United States in the Rocky Mountains, where this beetle has been a native insect, never at a devastating level. But with climate change, you have an extended season where it can develop two generations, longer, hotter droughts that stress more trees. All of a sudden, the environment changes, the host is more stressed, and the pest has more of an opening to it. You know, in all these different scenarios, or in our region in Minnesota, the bur oak trees are getting a disease called bur oak blight at an increasing rate because spring arrives earlier, it's warmer and it's wetter, but a pathogen that's been there all along then all of a sudden has a changed environment that favors it more. It's a useful concept on many levels, explaining why things are shifting with more disease or insects during climate change, or how we can put our focus on things that are not just how do you kill these pathogens or pests.
No, we've got the same thing in the southeast with sycamore getting sooty bark disease as well, because it's just been hotter and drier, and we've lost a lot of sycamore.
Hello, this is Tree Lady Talks, and I'm Sharon Durdant-Hollenby. All music and production is by Noel Durdant-Hollenby, and all views expressed by me or the interviewees are entirely personal.
How are things in terms of assessing trees when a new development's proposed?
Oh, I see some practitioners using the sonic tomography, and the technology for it is not as expensive as I would have expected. But still, there's not a lot of people doing that. It just seems like most of the time builders are still into the notion that, well, if I take the extra time to preserve trees, it costs more, and then I'll lose the project bid to some other competitor that doesn't care. And the arborist is called out at the very end when they've already just destroyed most of the trees and everything is stressed or injured. There was a friend of a friend. He would call me out in the middle of a project and ask me what to do to save this tree. And I would tell him, it's too late. You've already injured it, probably past the point of return. But that wasn't what he wanted to hear. And then he stopped calling me. It seems harder to get the proactive approach that's necessary really across. Although you get into the eastern United States, Wellesley College, they would spend any amount of money to preserve the trees on their campus. But you know, their campus is basically an arboretum. It's really a beautiful place. And they add an extra $40,000 onto a bid to hand dig around the roots of a tree rather than just rip in with a backhoe.
I mean, I just wondered, in where you are, is it a requirement when a building is planned and has to get planning permission to have a tree report?
Yes, a lot of the outlying communities, the suburbs, they'll say if you're removing trees that you have to replace a certain number of diameter area of trees after that. Each community will sort of have its own policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably much less restrictive than it is in the UK because,
yeah,
you know, the US is relatively more the Wild West than pretty much anywhere in Europe.
Yeah, it's well, we're pleased it's restricted here in terms of what's required. There's a lot of reporting and surveying beforehand, a consideration with varying successes. Where do you think arboriculture is going in the US?
Well, as we mentioned before, there's more women, there's more people of other backgrounds, racial backgrounds, getting into this trade, and the young people have a lot of energy about a green, sustainable future. When you can overlay this with the technology, I'm not a big technology person myself, but what becomes possible with GIS mapping and these kind of things, it really opens up a broader horizon of what we can get done, what we can focus on, and where we place our attention to deliver results to respond to climate change. You know, we have a real opportunity. Since trees are basically just solar-powered towers built out of carbon and sunlight, there will be, I don't think, any other better technology for extracting carbon out of the air. And the young people get that. All of these things with biochar and the broadening out of who engages in arboriculture, those are really exciting things for me as I'm reaching kind of the later years of the career and going into more of the mentor stage. So I find that very exciting right now.
And going back to an earlier discussion about communication, you have written the greatest rap about a fungus that we've ever heard. You're going to deliver an extract of it to us.
All right. Well, I have my text in front of me for about 60 seconds of this. And I remember doing this in the hotel in Hong Kong and how this was all unrolled at that point. So,
okay, well, we're back in the studio. We've got the Tree Lady Talks band ready. Oof, oof, oof. That's not them, that's me. And I've got my baseball cap on backwards. And Kent is going to do the first ever tree rap. It's called Armillaria, but trust me, there is nothing scarier. And this is an extract from what is going to be a brilliant, brilliant rap track.
Malaria, nothing scarier. This disease is fatal to trees. It will bury ya. It all starts with damage to the root flare. Doing stupid stuff, harking pars in a group there. Ever heard of a facultative parasite? What's more, it's also a saprophyte. That means it eats wood both dead and living. It's a fungus that's all taking, no giving. In a while, it looks like some shoestrings. Before that, it's just a hidden white thing, growing under the bark, and just for lark. Why don't you see if it glows in the dark? Our malaria makes the trees look funny. Our malaria growing mushrooms with the color like honey. Unlike most tree diseases, this one infects any kind of tree it pleases. Oaks, linden, maples, and pines, all will suffer, going to decline. Once it started, there's nothing you can do to change this condition with a very wide host range. There is no kind of treatment, no effective medication, no shamanistic rituals, no Buddhist meditation. No kind of hocus pocus can save your honey locust. And anyone who say they can is just a bunch of jokers.
I don't know about you, but I'm still doing Oops Upside Your Head. I mean, do you remember that from the Gap Band?
Oh, yeah.
Ah, Oops Upside Your Head, said Oops Upside Your Head. I mean, yeah. I you know, it's just, what? That rap was just brilliant. Did you like that?
I loved it.
I tell you what, that's just an extract of that track, and it's just belting. Obviously, if anybody wants to hear more of it, send me an email. Send an email to noel@treeladytalks.co.uk. I'll see what I can do. Absolutely brilliant. Anyway, well, I think it's time for that question.
And finally, Kent, what is your dream scenario?
I guess I would say that we've got the whole world sort of turned into a communal arboretum, and we really understand more about what happens below ground, that we don't just think of trees as this isolated individual thing that everyone likes to hug, but that it's connected to the entire world. You know, every time you take a breath, you're connected to a tree. And walking on the ground, the parts of the tree that we don't even really see, but it's connected to billions of organisms below the surface, that we have a much greater understanding of how to work with that. I guess that's my dream scenario.
Well, I love that. It's all about what's underground and how we and everything is connected. And if everybody could really appreciate that, and I think we're getting there, but we've got a long way to go.
Okay, well, thanks again.
So Kent, I mean, what a fascinating man. And I mean, he's living in at the moment, -25 degrees.
It's almost as cold as the UK today.
Good God, I think, I mean, there's bears walking around with frostbite and God knows what's at the moment in Minnesota. And I love the sound of Minneapolis. That's just a nice place to live. It sounds like a nice place to live.
It sounds wonderful.
Like everybody else at the moment. I mean, anywhere sounds like a nice place to live apart from where you're living right now.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Fantastic. Just brilliant, really interesting.
Oh, do you know what? This cold weather, it makes me want to snuggle up and comfort eat.
Yeah, it just makes my teeth go...
I know. And what do we like to eat when it's cold and cuddly?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, I just, you know, stews, stuff like that. I like a nice stew. I like a dumpling every now and again, as you well know. Okay, so it's time to talk about next week's guest.
We're speaking to Craig Sams. Craig Sams is an entrepreneur and a deep thinker about all things macrobiotic food, the soil, and latterly people know him for carbon gold in the industry. But everybody knows green and black chocolate.
Oh, green Yum. And black chocolate. Tell me.
We have a really good chat about what it means to be a fair trade business and all about organic farming of chocolate. and really just how important the soil is for everything. What a great conversation it is.
I'll also give viewers and listeners some tips on how you make a shiny chocolate sauce to go on your profiteroles. But wait a minute, there's news on the wire.
Don't forget, if you love this podcast and you love tree podcasts, hop over to Nature's Architects with Pete and Jennifer Wharton. Their episode this week is Does Money Grow on Trees?
Well, of course it does. I know someone whose entire life has been existing by getting money off a money tree.
A really in-depth chat with Charles Cocking and Luke Fay about running a business.
Oh, hold on, they're on the phone now. Wait a minute, let's see what they've got to say about it. Hit the subscribe button to guarantee you don't miss an episode, and you can follow us on
Twitter at TheTreeLady67,
Instagram TreeLadyTalks,
Facebook Sharon Hosegood Associates,
or send an email to Noel, that's N-O-E-L, at TreeLadyTalks.co.uk. So until next time, from the igloo that is the Tree Lady Talks studio, it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from him.
Triangle. And don't forget,
our malaria, nothing scarier.